Willkommen zum Hi-Podcast mit Sophie Ronschka und Christoph Käse.
The mission to create the map of a human being, what became the International Human Genome Project, was a massive undertaking. Officially launched in 1990, this was biology's first foray into big science, a consortium of more than 2,000 researchers in 20 labs in 6 countries, all working on one problem.
Vor 20 Jahren entschlüsselten Wissenschaftlerinnen und Wissenschaftler im Rahmen des Human Genome Projects erstmals das menschliche Genom. Das internationale Großprojekt kostete damals 2,7 Milliarden Dollar und dauerte ganze 13 Jahre. Dank moderner Technologien sind heute sowohl die Kosten als auch die Zeit für eine vollständige Genomsequenzierung drastisch gesunken. Heutzutage dauert es nur wenige Stunden und kostet einige hundert Dollar. Diese Fortschritte ermöglichen hochwirksame Krebstherapien. In Kliniken können Ärzte den genetischen Code von Tumoren analysieren und Computer entwickeln maßgeschneiderte Medikamente, die gezielt auf diese Zelltypen und Mutationen wirken. Die heilende Therapie kann so kurz danach verabreicht werden. Nun gibt es einen weiteren Durchbruch, ganz aktuell. Eine Studie von Moderna weckt Hoffnung auf den weltweit ersten mRNA-Krebsimpfstoff. Gibt es also bald ein wirksames Medikament gegen eine besonders schwere Form von Hautkrebs? Laut Studiendaten des Pharmakonzerns wirkt der neuartige mRNA-Impfstoff des Herstellers dauerhaft. Und weil wir dieses Thema so spannend finden, produzieren wir für Sie und euch ein Weekend-Special dazu, das Samstag um 5.55 Uhr zu hören ist. Und für alle die, die es nicht abwarten können oder sich schon mal vorbereiten wollen, die können sich nochmal von Dr. Christopher Mason aus unserer Folge 230 briefen lassen. Christopher Mason ist Professor für Genomik, Physiologie und Biophysik an der Cornell University in New York. Und auch mit dabei ist bzw. war Dr. Hadi Saleh. Er ist selbst auch Arzt und CEO von Ceramtech. Wir haben die beiden damals bei einem Event von World Minds zusammengebracht und es ist ein sehr, sehr spannendes Interview dabei rausgekommen. Also, wir hören noch mal rein, was die beiden uns erzählt haben.
Chris, thank you for being with us.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
When patients come to your clinic with a tumor, you take probes of that tumor and sequence the DNA. How quick is this done these days?
It's extraordinary. You can have it done within a day. It's something that used to take a decade to complete. To sequence the first human genome, it took about 10 years and billions of dollars across dozens of sites contributing. But now, literally, with a device that's in my hand, I could take a blood sample, extract the DNA, start sequencing, and have results within a few hours. And for your tumor, it could take a bit of tumor and then compare it to normal tissue. And again, have that all done within a day. So we see the specific mutations for your specific cancer and have drugs that target the exact mutations that are driving your cancer. And actually, even more exciting, if the cancer comes back, we can then sequence it again to see, has it mutated? Has it changed? And then adjust the therapy accordingly.
So you sequence the DNA, and then happens what? You compare it to a big database and see what kind of medicine would work, or do you produce a specific, let's say, antidote to that specific tumor cell?
Good question. So the first part is relative to known databases. We compare to every other sequenced human being we've ever seen that's public, and also compared to our own database at the hospital. What are other cancer patients who, say, have the same kind of leukemia or lymphoma or breast cancer or pancreatic cancer? Each cancer is actually very much has its own landscape of mutations. So we compare to other cancers. But I think what's even more exciting is when you have a mutation that normally shows up in one type of cancer, like a lung cancer, but then it can show up in a different cancer, can show up in your liver, but it's the same mutation. For example, EGFR is a growth factor gene, but you don't even really care where in your body the tumor is. You just care that it's there and you want to target it. So since we have a genetic view of cancer now, it doesn't matter so much where in your body it is, but it matters what kind of mutation is. So it's precision medicine. The precision is to the gene that carries that specific mutation. And to your question, the second point though, could you make a cancer vaccine, a personalized cancer vaccine? Actually, Moderna has started doing clinical trials. We're working with them to look at your specific tumor and try and make a specific mRNA vaccine that could prime your immune system to look for those cancer cells.
So vaccine is most of the time given before something happens, but in this case, the tumor is already there. Can the vaccine reduce the existing tumor?
Yes, early again, it's very early, but the idea is it would help the immune system be trained to look for the tumor and then have it actively kill it. Because if you think about it, we already have one of the best cancer killing systems in the whole world is just our immune system. But as we age, it gets older, it stops working. Well, as we age, lots of things stop working, and that includes the immune system. But you can prime it, you can reactivate it, like going to the gym for your immune system.
So when working on a specific patient and you sequence the DNA, what happens next? The next day in the hospital, would you go to the bed of the patient and tell him or her what?
We say we have sequenced your tumor and we have the best possible drug or targeted therapy that can go basically take the cancer cells and look for their Achilles heel, their weakness, and then target it. But the other thing we can do is that now that we know this tumor, we can also use what are called CAR T therapies or what are called chimeric antigen receptor therapies. You basically can then also reprogram T cells or these immune cells to target the cancer. So you can actually target the specific cancer. If you already have a drug, then you match it, the mutation of the gene, the DNA to the drug. But what's even more exciting is you can start to do these customized vaccines. You can also take T cells out of your body, these immune cells, reprogram them in the lab, and then infuse them. So usually when we go talk to the patient the second or third day, we say we have a series of options. The targeted therapy usually first, which often has lower toxicity. People think of chemotherapy normally when they think of cancer, which is basically like taking, you know, a bat and beating all of your cells. So it kills cancer cells, but it also ravages your body. People lose their hair. But it's a lot of the targeted therapies that have low or sometimes no toxicity because you're just targeting only those cells that carry that specific mutation. And some of these new immunotherapies have been cures where you can actually reprogram the T cells and re-customize the immune system to attack the cancer. So we describe all these therapies to patients. But
so how long does it take for you to produce the medicine, the therapeutical instrument?
For small drugs, they're little small molecules. If they're already established by different companies, we can just order them right away. For these customized T cell therapies or customized vaccines, those will take usually a few weeks. You can, in theory, there's a discussion that we could try and have banks of cells. Like you think of a blood bank, where if you need to get a blood donor, you go to the blood bank and you get a donation. There's work at our hospital and others to try and make these batches of immune cells that you could use for multiple cancers. And it's early days, but I think in the near future, you would have all these options available to you within a matter of a week or two instead of waiting, you know, months or years.
This is clinical practice today at Cornell University, or is it upcoming?
It's happening as we speak. It's actually, it's exciting just, I think, I view it as normal, but I realize that most people in the audience might think, I didn't even know it was happening at all. But it is the standard of care at Cornell, at our hospitals, New York Presbyterian. And I think what's even more exciting is you think of a tumor, say like a lung tumor or something, you take a needle, you take a little chunk of the tumor and you sequence that. But I think what's exciting is even if you don't even have to do that, you could just sequence the blood of someone, what's called cell-free DNA. There's fragments of DNA that are from cells when they die, they release all of their DNA into your bloodstream. And you can see if there's any bits of cancer cells, you can actually see these mutations and pick them up from the blood. So I've had this happen actually for my uncle who was diagnosed with lung cancer, the fine needle aspirate, which means you basically go in and try and get a little bit of the tumor. It failed in the clinic, but then we just ran a cell-free DNA test and were able to find the mutation and confirm it later and use that to drive the therapy. So you can find the tumor, and if it comes back, you can monitor to see how much of it's coming back.
So the classical way of treatment would be surgery and chemo. Does the new technology make these two approaches obsolete?
It's a good question. Surgery, for most cancers, you still want to get rid of the mass. It is a giant, you know, pile of evil cells somewhere in your body. So usually you still do some surgery and you often will still do some radiation or even a low dose chemotherapy just to broadly shrink the tumors before you do surgery. It is still good clinical practice. So they're all tools that we still use, but they're becoming less common. So broad chemotherapy like azacitidine or other therapies are becoming less common because if you can have something that specifically targets one kind of cell, particularly a cancer cell, it's much easier on the body and much more specific. So whenever possible, we try to do a targeted or an immunotherapy. But those are still tools in the tool shed. If you have someone that's a cancer that's really metastasized and is in multiple places of the body, you'll take every weapon you can to that battle.
You talked about cost of the first sequencing of human DNA. What is the cost of this very quick sequencing that is happening in clinical practice today?
It's extraordinary. So even just 10 years ago, it was about $100,000. And 20 years ago, again, it was billions of dollars. But today, you can get it all done for about $200 of the cost of reagents. So sometimes a fancy dinner might cost more than it would take to save your life, you know.
And so this is full cost, including personnel and equipment? No, it's probably $700, including everything.
That's right. So if you include an amortization of the equipment, the labor, the clinical lab, informatics, reporting, you know, insurance, paperwork, basically as well, that gets to about $700 or $800. But that's it.
How come that sequencing is so cheap and so quick today?
This has been a mixture of technology and innovation and competition have really driven the cost down. In particular, the sequencing prices came down because you had multiple companies competing in 2006 and 7 and 8 to get essentially the fastest way to, instead of sequence one molecule of DNA, which was called Sanger sequencing, where you would see basically one molecule that might be several hundred bases long. So remember, the human genome is 3 billion letters long. So if you're sequencing something that's a few hundred, one at a time, it will take you a long time. That's why the first human genome took so long. Even with multiple groups doing all the sequencing, it's just not that much throughput. But there were multiple platforms that were announced in the mid-2000s, the mid-noughties, where it was Illumina, Life Technologies, IonTorrent, PacBio, these different companies that realized instead of just sequencing one molecule of DNA, you can have a good camera effectively watch millions or even now billions of small reactions happen at the same time. And at each reaction, you're building a strand of DNA. You're seeing when you take like blood out of your arm and you kind of wash it over that, it looks like a microscope slide, but then you have billions of fragments of your DNA and they begin a reaction on each one of them. And so if you, the cameras got good enough and then the computational tools got fast enough that you could then image and analyze billions of reactions all at the same time. And
so it's an optical method.
Yeah, because you can actually see the nucleotides when they get incorporated. Each one of them carries something called a fluorophore, which is kind of like if you imagine if you're hiking in the woods and if everyone had a different backpack, but they had one of four lights on them and you could see people walking in the woods, you'd say if it's an A, C, G, or a T, the different nucleotides of our genetic code, if you attach kind of a little light onto each base and you take a picture, you can see what base is there, and then you wash it and then repeat, wash and repeat. And you do this for many cycles, billions of reactions at a time.
Cancer at its source, what kind of disease is it? It has been said many times that cancer as a disease doesn't exist because it's just a label for many, many different diseases. Is that true, or is it one disease?
Cancer is, I would agree, is many diseases. For example, Richard Nixon, our president in the 70s, said we'll cure cancer within 5 years. And, you know, I think it's because a lot of people thought we had a view into these oncogenes or these genes that drive cancer. So, and we're still discovering oncogenes, though we haven't finished finding them. But it's extraordinary that people say the curing a cancer, but there are many kinds of cancer. It would be just as fallacious to say, I have an organ replacement that I can replace any organ in your body. That sounds magical because it is magical. It doesn't exist because every organ is different. You want a heart transplant, a liver transplant, a kidney. Every organ is different, and all the cancers of the body arise usually in a different tissue. So each tissue is defined by a different genetic and what's called epigenetic landscape, meaning how are those cells programmed and what will they respond to. So for example, some kinds of leukemia, we've been curing at 95% success rate for 20 years with all trans retinoic acid. So we know some cancers we can cure today very well, almost all of that type. But pancreatic cancer or glioblastoma, we have very little progress over 30, 40 years. They're much harder. They have much more complex genetics and epigenetics. So they'll take more work. But so I'd say we can have some cures for some cancers sometimes, but
pancreas tumor is what killed Steve Jobs, right? It's also very difficult to operate because pancreas is hidden deep inside the body. How well is the cause of cancer understood today?
That's a good question. So there are some classical papers called the hallmarks of cancer and what defines cancer. Some of the hallmarks include the ability to continue to grow without responding to checkpoints, the sort of, you know, eternal youth of those cancer cells. They also don't respond to external cues that might be trying to get them to stop. They can avoid the immune system, like we just talked about. So they have some of these known hallmarks. But what's extraordinary is, as I was saying before, we now have sequenced the DNA of enough tumors, we can see consistent patterns come up again and again that cancers can be very well defined and then, of course, treated by their specific genetic profile. And sometimes you'll see surprises. Like, for example, you think of BRCA1 or BRCA1. People have probably heard of that. That's a gene that gives you a high risk of getting breast or ovarian cancer. And so people probably heard of Angelina Jolie. She had her breasts removed, did a prophylactic mastectomy just because she was carrying the mutations in those genes just to be safe. And so some genes we know very well, but BRCA1 is important for breast and ovarian cancer, but also 15 other cancers. You'll see the same mutations in the same gene that help drive the cancer. So I think we've now learned, we've sequenced enough cancer genomes that we know genetically there are differences, but also epigenetically, this idea of how DNA is not just A, C, Gs, and Ts, but how it's packaged and how it's modified, it also changes the cancer. And so we have epigenetic therapies that are also coming online that change how DNA is packaged and controlled and kind of, you know, basically like you pack up your sleeping bag. If you pack it up one way, it'll fit. If a different way, it doesn't fit quite well. And the same thing has to happen to our DNA when we package it up in our cells. But in cancer, it's often completely aberrant and it doesn't package it the same way. So we can target that epigenetically as well.
You mentioned mRNA technology. What role does it play in the strategy you just described?
The mRNA vaccines by Moderna and Pfizer and the several other companies working on similar ideas, they have really changed the ability to find a molecule that you want the immune system to learn and respond to. So they are very new, but obviously they've been helpful for the COVID-19 pandemic. But eventually it'll be for other pathogens and also for what are called these epitopes, or basically pieces on the outside of cells that your immune system recognizes. And we're seeing these deployed now for personalized cancer therapy. So you make like an mRNA vaccine, like you've seen for COVID, but you make it specifically for your exact tumor. And those are multiple clinical trials that have already started to see how well they work.
So the BioNTech founders claiming that they can at least not cure, but at least ameliorate cancer and moving the research facilities to London, there is some promise in that approach?
Absolutely. I think it is. It's like any approach. We'll start with clinical trials with a few people, begin to expand it. You know, for COVID, we had to do clinical trials with tens of thousands of people because we were in a hurry. It was a pandemic. But for most clinical trials, they start very slowly. We monitor for any what's called, you know, this rejection of the therapy, or even a cytokine release syndrome, is where basically your body gets inflamed. Actually, kind of like what Scott Kelly looked like when he landed back on Earth after a year. He had this big cytokine release, and his body was really...
Scott Kelly being the twin in your twin experiment.
Yes, yeah. So he went to space for a year and an identical twin on Earth. And when he landed after a year, we saw these big spikes in cytokines, which are inflammatory and anti-inflammatory signals in your body that tell it, like if you get a cut, you start to notice it gets inflamed, and it tells your immune system, though, to begin to help clear the wound and heal the wound. Same thing can happen, though, in your body, where if something is a new drug or a new therapy, it can really have your body react strongly to it.
Science voted AlphaFold as one of the most important breakthroughs in biology and in science overall last year, I think it was, predicting proteins and their three-dimensional structure with AI. Is that in any case helpful for treatment of cancer?
Yes, actually. So being able to predict the exact shape of every protein and how they interact with other proteins, but also how they interact with drugs. It used to be some people would spend their entire PhD modeling one protein with one drug and studying it for 5 years to see how it would move in 10 nanoseconds. And that was a whole PhD. People still get their PhDs on this called molecular modeling. But with AlphaFold, now you can make the predictions faster. You can test not only the shape, but also how it will likely change when something binds to that protein. So it's really changed the speed and scale at which we can do some of this modeling, and it's been fabulous.
I want to bring in somebody else into the conversation, which is Hadi Zaleh. He is the CEO of SerumTech, a doctor himself, a medical doctor himself. You run a medical technology company. You were listening to what we're discussing right now. Hadi, your question, your remarks.
I have so many questions. Have you tested yourself for genetic predispositions for any cancers
Yes, actually, I ran recently the GRAIL test, which looks at DNA and also methylation marks, those epigenetic marks in my cell-free DNA. And so far, I'm negative for risk of cancer so far. So, but it's GRAIL's currently running a large trial in the UK to see, essentially, can you see cancer in someone 1 or 2 or 5, maybe 10 years before it really becomes serious by looking at that cell-free DNA? So it is, I've been running it on myself, and we have several of our clients and patients who've run it. But GRAIL is not yet clinically approved, but it has a lot of potential, as I've been alluding to this whole time. You get so much information from these fragments of DNA in your blood that what if we did this every year when you get a general checkup so you could try and see as early as possible the cancer? And yeah, so far negative.
In your twin study, the astronaut twin came back with longer telomeres. How do you explain that?
For the audience, just tell us what the telomere is, please.
Yeah, the telomere is at the end of your chromosomes, and your chromosomes contain all of your DNA in the middle of your cells. At the end of those chromosomes are these little, kind of like at the ends of shoelaces, where you have the little plastic that keeps your shoelaces from unraveling. Telomeres are the same thing for your DNA. They keep your chromosomes together and keep it from unraveling. Now, normally, telomeres actually shrink as you age, a sign generally that the cells have gotten older and that you've gotten older, as they naturally shrink over time. But in the astronauts, they actually got longer. Actually, we've seen it for the twin study, for NASA missions, for the SpaceX mission I was just talking about earlier today. It seems to be in space they get longer, and we've seen this also on Earth. If you irradiate cells at a low dose, it is partly a response to radiation, so the cells are priming in what's called the basically this TERA, is an RNA that's at the end of chromosomes, also gets activated. So we can see the body, we believe it's mostly from the radiation, where the body and the cells are kind of primed and reacting to that.
So does this correlate with infrared light therapy, for example, or is it more like X-ray radiation?
We haven't checked with, it's probably X-ray. We think X-ray or low dose galactic cosmic rays also, they go through all of us rarely, but in space you get more of them. And so I think it's more heavier radiation. But we could try different kinds of radiation. That's a great question to see which one's the best priming.
So if I travel a lot long distance, transatlantically, do I get older?
Because you're going closer to the speed of light, you get somewhat technically younger, but not enough to make a difference. But you will accumulate more subtle mutations by getting more radiation. But it is, what's amazing though, is now we can start to monitor that. You know, 20 years ago, you would just have to look for a mole or hope that you weren't getting cancer. But now we can sequence all the cell-free DNA in your body and see, well, are you on your way to cancer? Are you avoiding it as far as we can tell? So it's a... So I mean, I think you'll be okay. You look fine right here, at least. The listeners can't see this, but Hadi looks great. It's good.
You did talk a lot about the democratization of access to health and to therapy. Now, Cornell is a top university, not accessible for everybody. How can the technology that you're talking about be distributed to poorer countries, poorer communities, so that as many people as possible can profit from it?
It's really a brave new world where these sequencers are now, instead of being $1 million for the machine, are down to about $1,000. So you can get these really tiny sequencers and deploy them really globally. Now, $1,000 is still a lot of money for most of the world, but there are philanthropic programs like the Rockefeller Foundation or Gates Foundation that are helping try and get the hardware and the training out to the communities and to the sort of lower resource environment so people can access the technology. And then once you have sort of a Starlink satellite, there's now satellites, internet almost everywhere on Earth, or it will be there in about a year, almost everywhere. You can then, in theory, upload the data and use the cloud for your informatics. So you don't have to hire a bunch of programmers and have a large dedicated resource facility for compute. You can do it on the cloud.
In therapy, do you need a lot of expertise to apply it to the patients, or could it be easily trained to any doctor without specific education?
In theory, it's a good question. The AI algorithms are getting much better, so a lot of it feeds off all the large-scale data. So you always want to do it in concert with medical staff, because every patient is different, every tumor is a little bit different, but we can now learn from every other cancer patient who's ever been sequenced, analyzed, and the data has been shared. So our capacity for matching the right patient with the right drug and at the right time is unparalleled. So you can do a lot of it on the cloud there as well.
Maybe finishing question, the human being such a complex animal, how can such a thing be coded with so few letters in the chromosome?
Yeah, so only 3 billion letters to define all of our thousands of types of cells, our immune system, our, you know, our brains. Think of your brain as the seat of dreams and hopes and visions and your personality. It creates art, creates music and science, all these other facets, all from 3 billion letters. I think it is, it's not just the number of letters, it's really what's in that book of life. And we've seen humans do have some pieces of DNA that we don't see in other species. We have a lot more connections in our brain than we see the density of those connections than other species. So it is extraordinary to think that such a small bit of genetic code can create so many things that also create things. But I think we're just in the early days of discovery, because we've now compared humans to chimps and bonobos and other primates, and we do see differences. We also see areas of the genome that rapidly evolved in the past few million years that we don't see at all in other primates. And so if you look ahead a few million years, it's possible we might see accelerated evolution, because we're now effectively controlling our own evolution. And so we could make it go better. We could also totally screw it up and make it go worse. But I'm hoping that we now can see this evolution in real time and kind of get to the next stage of human development.
3 million is just an astonishingly known number. A long novel is about 1 million letters, but there are 26, 27, in some languages a bit more, letters to the alphabet. Yes. In your alphabet, it's just 4 letters, so much less information per combination of letters. So how did nature squeeze this kind of information into such a code, such a limited code?
It is, even though the alphabet of genetics is only 4 letters, it does carry these epigenetic states, which I think is part of the answer, is that it enables these way you can package DNA, the way you modify the A, C, G, and the T. One of them is called methylcytosine, which is a small chemical tweak of the C that then changes whether something is turned on or turned off. So the best answer is, how do you get that much complexity from a single genetic code is the epigenetics. It's what's on top of genetics, meaning how you control and package and regulate and modify that DNA, which would be like, this is the best analogy, is if someone's reading a book to you, the intonation of how they read the book, or the accent, or, you know, when you see a play, it could be the same play, but if you see one play, you'll love the play. And if you see it by different actors, it might not feel as good, but it's the same play. It's just performed differently, and it's read differently, and really you see it differently. And so epigenetics enables the genetics to have many states.
Christopher Mason, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks so much.
And Hadi, thank you for joining as well.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Das waren Dr. Christopher Mason und Dr. Hadi Saleh im Interview. Und für alle die, die jetzt richtig neugierig geworden sind, keine Sorge, wir hören uns schon ganz bald, nämlich am Samstag mit einem Weekend-Special wieder. Und zwar wie immer um 5.55 Uhr. Also Samstag um 5.55 Uhr mit einem Weekend-Special. Bis dahin, schöne Woche, tschüss!
Das war der HI-Podcast für diese Woche. Wenn Sie keine Folge verpassen möchten, immer dienstags um 5.55 Uhr kommen wir heraus. Versprochen. Mögen Sie uns? Dann abonnieren Sie uns jetzt oder hinterlassen Sie einen Like. Wir freuen uns über Anregungen, Kritik und Wünsche. Schreiben Sie uns gerne an podcast@hi.co. Nicht .com, sondern .co. Eine Produktion der Axel Springer HI GmbH, einer führenden Beratung für Strategie und Umsetzung neuer Geschäftsmodelle. Wir engagieren uns leidenschaftlich für das Wachstum Ihres Unternehmens.